Thank you, Brother Chairman, and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, this evening then, we start, as it were, on our study proper in the first of these incidents now, in which is recorded the life story of Abraham and Sarah. We saw them, of course, this morning by way of introduction as we first drew near to examine the details of their lives. Now we're going to study in this first part in Genesis chapter 12, verse 10, through to chapter 13, verse 5, the story of their encountering trouble and testing together. And we're going to see the way in which, on this particular occasion, we believe that Abraham fell, and fell quite badly in terms of his faith and his courage. He let his wife down badly, and out of it we hope and we pray, in fact we know, that he learnt a valuable lesson. Now, Genesis chapter 12 then, in verse 10, starts this particular record by saying, "And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was grievous in the land." There was a famine in the land, says the record. So interesting, actually, because this is the very first occasion that the word famine is referred to in Scripture. And you see, Abraham was in a quandary, because, you see, back in verse 7, he'd been promised this, hadn't he? It says that Yahweh appeared unto Abraham and said, "Unto thy seed will I give this land. Unto thy seed will I give this land." And he had a barren wife on the one side who could not bear seed, and now he has a barren land that cannot bear fruit. And you see, everything that was about him appeared to be contrary to the promise, didn't it? A barren wife, a barren land, and yet the promise rested on those two things. And yet all appeared to be the absolute opposite of what God had promised. And so we're told that Abraham, in desperation, made a decision on behalf of the family, as if salvation depended upon himself. And so with the famine all about him, he made the fateful decision on behalf of the family that they would therefore, as the record says in the 10th verse, they would go down into Egypt. You know, isn't that a significant phrase? You always go down, you see, into Egypt, don't you? Now, you see, there's nothing wrong with going down into Egypt when it's directed by God. We're told, for example, in Genesis 46 and verse 1, or verse 3 actually, which we don't need to turn up, but it says, "Israel took his journey, and God spake unto Israel and said, I am Elohim, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation." So there's nothing wrong, you see, with going into Egypt when it's directed by God. We're told in Matthew chapter 2 and verses 13 to 15 that another famous family in New Testament times were instructed to take a little child down into Egypt. But when we're not told to go into Egypt by the divine direction, then it is in fact a retrograde step indeed. In fact, on another occasion, we're told by the prophet Isaiah, who says in his 30th chapter and at the second verse, he says, "Woe to those that walk to go down into Egypt, but have not asked at my mouth, says God." And this was Abraham's problem now, wasn't it? You see, he's made a decision on his own to go down into Egypt as if somehow that would solve his problems. Mind you, of course, you see what he says, verse 10, he's only going to sojourn there. "I'm only going to sojourn," you know, and the word sojourn means something temporary, doesn't it? It was a temporary expedient because of the difficulties of the situation. But you see, the scriptures are full of those who've gone into the world to sojourn. Aren't we told in Genesis chapter 13 and verse 12 of a man called Lot who pitched his tent toward Sodom, but by chapter 19 verse 1 is dwelling in the gate of Sodom? Aren't we told in Ruth chapter 1 verse 1 of a family under the headship of Elimelech who went to sojourn in the land of Moab, but who end in verse 4 dwelling there? Generally, those who say that they're going to sojourn in the world for just a short time don't end up in the world a short time. They stay there, you see, don't they? The world is never the place to answer our problems for life and the truth. Mind you, there was a reason, because you see verse 10 says the famine was grievous in the land. It was a very grievous famine, and the word means burdensome and severe. But you see, the real problem was this, not that there was a famine, but that Abraham, you see, did not understand that behind the famine there lay spiritual lessons to be learned. Abraham did not see that there was a spiritual dimension to life's problems. He only saw a natural problem requiring a natural solution. He didn't see that God's hand might be in the matter at all. And there's a tremendous lesson for us in life here, isn't there? That whatever comes upon us, however natural it might seem, is generally not natural at all. It's God-given. Just because it's a problem with a child, or a problem with work, or a problem with our finances, doesn't mean that it's outside of the scope of God's dealings with us. And the spirit of the truth should be for us to say, well, why has this problem come upon us? What should we be learning from this problem? What scriptural principles are involved? What's the divine mind on this matter? What would God want me to do? How would the Father want me to react in this particular situation? What lesson ought I to learn scripturally from this problem, from this difficulty? And yet somehow we don't do that, do we? Whenever we have a problem in life, a natural problem, the truth goes out the window. And we say, well, forget about the truth, I've got a problem here. And the lesson, you see, to Abraham was that he had to learn that there is a spiritual dimension to life's problems. There always is. We either learn and profit from them so that our character is developed, or we don't. And he hadn't seen that, you see, not at this stage. His faith isn't strong enough, you see. Do you notice in chapter 12, in verse 6, we're told that when Abram first came into the land, Abram passed through the land unto the place of Sychem, unto the plain of Moreh, and it says, verse 6, and the Canaanite was then in the land. Do you notice that? And then there's a famine, and Abram goes south into Egypt, and he comes back up finally into the promised land. Now when he comes back into the promised land, in chapter 13, and verse 7, we're told, and there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanite dwelled in the land. Now that's interesting, isn't it? You see, the question is, where did the Canaanite go during the famine? The answer is the Canaanite stayed in the land. And they were still there, still alive, still present when Abraham came back. So why did Abraham need to go if the Canaanite could survive? You see? He panicked. He faced a problem and he panicked. Here's the principle, Psalm 33. Let's have a look at this one. It's a nice psalm. Isn't this the lesson that Abram ought to have learned on this occasion? Psalm 33, and reading verses 18 and 19. If the Canaanite could survive in the land, then how much more should the faithful have been able to survive in the land? Did not Abraham understand that? And Psalm 33 captures the lesson in the 18th and 19th verses when it says, behold, the eye of Yahweh is upon them that fear him, upon them that hope in his mercy, to deliver their soul from death and to keep them alive in famine, says the psalm. The eye of Yahweh is upon them that fear him. But Abraham had forgotten this in the extremity of the situation, you see. He ought to have understood. And so ought we, in all the circumstances of life, and all the trials of family life, to remember that God's eye is always still upon those that fear him. He'll keep them alive. He'll send them sufficient food to relieve their needs. So Genesis 12 and verse 10 tells us that really on this occasion Abraham made his first bad mistake, you see, didn't he? He made a bad mistake in making this decision to head south. South, down into the land of Egypt. Mind you, I suppose we should say, as we close our thoughts on verse 10, that at least it's to his credit that he didn't do something else, because Hebrews 11 verse 15 says, in marking the faith of Abraham, it says, and he might have had opportunity to have returned to that land from whence he came. Remember those words in Hebrews 11? It says that he might have had opportunity to return. At least Abraham, you see, didn't go back to Ur of the Chaldees. Oh no, he'd left that behind. He'd crossed over from Ur of the Chaldees. He'd left behind the land of idolatry. He'd never go back to that. So at least there's a credit to his name there. But it wasn't a good move really, was it, on this occasion to head south down into the land of Egypt. Verse 11 says, it came to pass when he was come near to enter into Egypt that he said unto Sarai his wife, behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. It came to pass, says the record in verse 11, when he was come near to enter, he hadn't even got there yet, before he's even entered into the land of Egypt, he realizes his mistake. He knows there's a problem, you see. Before he's even reached the border, he suddenly realized, uh-oh, we're going to have troubles down here, and I haven't thought this through properly, not as properly as I should have. But you see, he'd already made the first mistake, and the first mistake was in verse 10. The first mistake was deciding to head off into the world to solve his problems anyway. Now, you see, sin's a funny thing, brothers and sisters and young people. Sin, you see, what happens is that when we make a concession to sin in our lives, somehow it leads to another one. When we make a concession to the principles of the truth in our lives, either personally or within our family or within the ecclesia, somehow, inevitably, it leads to yet another and generally greater concession, doesn't it? Now you think about the story of Genesis chapter 12. You see, what happens is this. He displays his own lack of faith first. Then he compromises his wife. Then he deceives the princes of Egypt. Then he implicates Pharaoh himself. Then he plunges the whole house of Egypt into disaster. Does Abraham? Sin's like that, you see. You know, we won't turn this reference up, but you know, this story of how sin, you see, sin does two things, doesn't it? It deceives and it multiplies. We ought always to remember those two things about sin. It deceives and it multiplies. You know, this episode here of how it multiplies is very similar to another one. And you might like to take a note of this reference, which we won't turn up, but the 2nd of Samuel, chapter 11, verse 1, verse 2, verse 4, verse 8, verse 15. I'll give you those again. 2nd of Samuel 11, verse 1, verse 2, verse 4, verse 8, verse 15. And you'll all know what that record is. It's the story of another man who made his first mistake when he didn't go out to battle at the time that other kings were out warring the warfare of faith, and he decided to stay home. Do you remember that man? And he walked upon the housetop and he saw a woman, and he compromised his own integrity, and he implicated the woman, and he implicated the husband, and then he brought Joab into the situation, and finally the whole house of Israel was plunged into disaster because David made a concession to sin. Oh, a very similar story, isn't it? Isn't there an old proverb that says this, and how true it is? Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. That's what sin is like, isn't it? Now, who was he talking to in verse 11? Came to pass, when he was come near to enter into Egypt, that he said unto Sarai, his wife. He said unto Sarai, his wife. She's always called this, you see, in the record. From the very moment, remember, that she enters in chapter 11, she's Sarai, Abram's wife. And so she is all the way through the story. She's Abram's wife. The whole problem, though, of course, in this story was that Abraham didn't appreciate, really, what it meant for this woman to be his wife. He doesn't understand the fullness of what this marriage is all about. She was his wife. But Abraham didn't understand the dimensions of exactly what that involved. Not yet. Not as yet. Now you see what he says in verse 11. He turns to his wife and he says, behold now, I know that thou art a fair woman to look upon. It's interesting actually that Blunt's scriptural coincidences makes a comment on this verse, and he says this, that you see in most parts of the Middle East a woman went heavily veiled. And so therefore a woman, no matter how beautiful she was, because she was heavily veiled, no other man saw her. I understand that there's a very beautiful princess in one of the United Arab Emirates. She is exceedingly beautiful, apparently. She's only ever been seen by two men in her life, her father and her husband. So why was Abraham worried about other people looking upon his fair wife? In verse 11 here, well, Blunt says, it just so happens that, you see, in Egypt the woman went unveiled. So it was a problem there. And because they were darker skinned in Egypt, he feared that the fairness and the beauty of his wife would be something that they would be attracted to. Now it's interesting, actually, she's about 65 at this stage, is young Sarah. Mind you, remember this, she dies at what age? 127. So if she's 65 and she dies at 127, then she's approximately middle-aged, isn't she? And she's still an extremely attractive woman. Now you think that's interesting. Wait till you get to chapter 20 and you find that she's an awful lot older and she's still attractive in chapter 20. We're going to come to the reasons for that later on. The secret of eternal life in Sarah in Genesis chapter 20. So Abraham's worried, isn't he, about what will happen. So what he says, therefore, what he proposes in the 12th verse is a solution. He says, look, he says, it shall come to pass when the Egyptians shall see thee, that they shall say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will save thee alive. Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake, and my soul shall live because of thee. So you see, Abraham is motivated by fear here. He thought that if she was his wife, they would kill him, but if she was his sister, they would leave him alone and alive. And so what really he suggests here in verse 12, it's only a little concession really. He says, look, he says, we're still married, dear. It's just that what we ought to do, you see, is keep the public matter, the public relationship of our marriage, we'll actually compromise the public relationship. From a public point of view, it won't be clear that we're married at all. We still will be, of course, but not in public. All right? Say you are my sister. Now, Abraham was wrong on this, wasn't he? He was very wrong, actually. He was wrong on several different counts. I've got at least four reasons here why Abraham was quite wrong in terms of the suggestion he proposes. Let's just have a look at that in terms of Abraham's mistakes here. Now, here's the first one. You see, it was a brilliant solution from Abraham's point of view. His life would be spared. No one would be looking at him or worrying about him. The only problem was that it solved his problem, but it didn't really solve his wife's, did it? In fact, it increased the danger for Sarah, because what he was really suggesting here was that he withdraw the protection of his role as a husband. You know, we've said that husbands ought to learn the principle of sacrifice. Abraham says, oh, I understand sacrifice, I'm going to sacrifice you. No, that's not quite right, is it, really? He casts the whole problem on Sarah, and he removed his protection as a husband. Now, that wasn't the right thing to do, was it? How could any husband do that to the wife of his love? Now, here's the second thing, and I think in some ways this is a more serious one in terms of Abraham's spiritual mindedness, you see, or lack thereof. Because, you see, the land had been promised to his seed. By the way, the land hasn't even been promised to Abraham yet, only to his seed. Did you notice that? Genesis 12, verse 7. You notice that? Under thy seed will I give this land. Not to Abraham. He doesn't get the promise till chapter 13. At the moment, it's only promised to the seed. But the thing is that the seed hasn't been born. And not only has the seed not been born, it hasn't even been conceived as yet. So if the seed hasn't been conceived as yet, then it's impossible for Abraham to lose his life, isn't it? Because it's got to be his child. So here's a promise that rests on a seed that is going to spring from this man and this woman. The child has not yet been conceived, then their lives are inviolate. But Abraham didn't understand that, did he? He hadn't worked out, really, the implications of the promise, had he? Either for himself, or especially for himself in this particular case, his life was safe. If only he could realise that. But you see,
it wasn't just that. The third error that he makes on this occasion was
that in moving the threat to his wife, what Abraham was doing was jeopardising her position as the bearer of the seed, and indicating thereby his lack of appreciation of her involvement. And one of the things that we're going to see in this story is the way that Abraham's understanding is gradually increased to the point where he realises this was not just going to be his child, it was going to be their child. That Sarah was intimately involved in this promise as much as he was. They were in it together. He doesn't actually understand that at the moment. I think that when Abraham was told, "Unto thy seed will I give this land," he saw that as his boy, his child. He hadn't seen his wife's involvement. And he shows that by what he's prepared to do here. He was going to jeopardise her position. And the fourth thing on which he was wrong is that what had he really done? Well, what he'd really done on the basis of fear was he had prejudged the character and the standard of the Egyptians, hadn't he? He prejudged what they were going to do and what they would be like. And the fact of the matter is, he was wrong. Subsequent events proved that he had been most unfair in his assessment of their character. So you see, Abraham was wrong, we believe, on at least four different counts in terms of his reasoning in this particular matter, when in verses 12 and 13 he makes this proposal of compromise and of concession to his beloved wife. This is not Abraham at his best, is it? This is Abraham making bad mistakes one after the other. This is a man who's not yet matured in faith. This is a man who does not see things through spiritual eyes as yet. Now verse 13 says, "Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister." Of course she was, wasn't she? Chapter 20, verse 4 of Genesis says they had the same father. So really it was true, wasn't it? Now it wasn't true, brothers and sisters, because even though they may have had the same father, the fact of the matter is that this was uttered with the intention to deceive. And that's a lie, isn't it? There's not really such a thing, you know, as a half-truth. It was a lie. Deliberately uttered with the intention to deceive. And the fact is that irrespective of whether she was his sister or no, the real issue was she was his wife. And that's what he was trying to hide, wasn't it? No, this is wrong. This is not good. This is not Abraham, the father of the faithful. Not yet. Do you notice that just before this incident, that Abraham is seen in a certain posture? Verse 8 of Genesis 12. It says that just before this episode occurs, he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east, and there he built an altar unto Yahweh, and here it is, he called upon the name of Yahweh. That's prayer, isn't it? He was involved in prayer just before the beginning of this episode. And when we come out the other side of the episode, in chapter 13 and verse 4, it says, "Unto the place of the altar which he'd made there at the first, and there Abram called on the name of Yahweh." So you see, Abraham is seen in the posture of prayer just before and just after this episode. But right now, in the middle of the crisis, when prayer would have been so tremendously helpful to him, there's no mention of prayer. Not in the middle of the problem. And you see, there's a lesson here, isn't there? And I think the lesson is this, that you see, when we get involved with the world, it diminishes our spiritual perception. You know, one of the hardest things is to try and assess a problem in life when we're already entangled in the middle of the problem. It's the hardest thing to be spiritually objective when we're already in the middle of it all. I suppose one of the lessons, therefore, of this whole episode, isn't it, is that wisdom says, both in terms of marriage and family life, and for that matter ecclesial life, is we've got to develop the skill of seeing ahead. You know, there's a proverb that says, a prudent man foresees evil and hides himself. He sees ahead to the problems that are likely to come if we go this way or that way. If we do this or do that spiritually, there is a possible problem, and we seek to avoid that before it even occurs. Abraham's in the thick of a problem here now, when he could well do with prayer to his God, and he's silent. There's no reference to prayer at all. He's right in the midst of it and struggling with his own problems. Well, problems they were, because verse 14 goes on to say, it came to pass that when Abram was come into Egypt, that the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. Which, by the way, I suppose really says that exactly what Abraham feared happened. It happened exactly as he thought it would. And verse 15 says, the princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Now, you see the word woman in verse 14 and the word woman in verse 15. That's the word ishah in the Hebrew, but the interesting thing about it's the same word translated wife in verse 11, wife in verse 12, wife in verse 17, wife in verse 18, wife in verse 19. And you see, that was the great problem. She wasn't just a woman, was she? She was another man's wife. And that's where the whole crisis was. And the princes that saw this woman and commended her fairness did not realize that she belonged to a man. She was married to him. Now, you see, we understand why Abraham did what he did. I mean, we know that he was motivated by fear. We all understand that. But you see, one of the hard things to appreciate, and I personally find it hard to appreciate, is, see, it's all well planning these things in theory, isn't it? Say, look, I'll tell you what we'll do. You tell me, you know, and then we'll, and that, you know. It's all well planning these things out in theory, but what happens in the reality of life? And you see, what happened was, here they are living in a house in Egypt, and one day, and the princes of Pharaoh arrive, and they say, we are commanded to take this woman into the household of Pharaoh, into the royal harem of Egypt. Now, what do you do then? There's the real test. What do you do then? And Sarah looked at her husband. And Abraham looked at her. And what was Abraham going to do? And they did look at each other. Can you imagine that look, brothers and sisters? Can you imagine that look between a husband and a wife? What do we do? One last eloquent look. And then Abraham looked away. He looked down. And the die was cast. And he watched his wife being led away into another man's house. How could he do that, brothers and sisters? How could he do that? You see, Abraham, although he was a man of faith, he lacked natural courage. He was a timid man. And he absolutely failed on this occasion to rise to the headship of his house. At the moment when his wife needed him, he let her down badly. Very badly. Let her down completely. And she was led away. Now, it's interesting, actually, because you see, this chapter talks about three things. It talks about Abraham speaking about how fair his wife was in verse 11. It talks about suggesting that she call herself his sister in verse 13. And it ends with her going into the household of Pharaoh in verse 15. Come and have a look at the Song of Solomon. Now, you see, here is a proverb or a poem upon the marriage of Christ and his bride in the age to come. The Song of Solomon in chapter 4. Just have a look at this by way of contrast with the circumstances of Genesis chapter 12. Now you see, Song of Solomon chapter 4 celebrates the time when the Lord Jesus Christ and his love, his bride, will enter into the promised land together. And there we're told that the bridegroom says of the bride in the Song of Solomon 4 verse 9, "Thou hast ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. Thou hast ravished my heart with one of thine eyes, with one chain of thy neck. How fair is thy love, my sister, my spouse." Verse 12, "A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed." Words and terms, brothers and sisters, that refer to the fact that this woman belonged to him. A fountain sealed. She was his and none other. And what a contrast that is with the disaster of Genesis chapter 12. Here's the Lord leading his wife into the promised land, and Abraham is leading his wife out of the promised land down into Egypt. Here's the Lord saying how fair his love is out of delight for her. Abraham comments on the fairness of his wife out of sheer fear of her beauty. The Lord says concerning this one in verse 10 that she is both his sister and his spouse. But Abraham suggests that Sarah call him sister instead of his spouse. And here is the Lord celebrates the fact that the bride is a garden enclosed, verse 12, belonging to him. Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, as it were, hands over the key to his garden to another man and watches his wife walk away. No, this is not Abraham in a good light, is it? Come back to verse 16 of Genesis chapter 12. It says in verse 16 that he entreated Abram well for her sake. Actually, that's interesting, because you see that phrase, well for her sake, that really comes from verse 13, doesn't it? "Say, I pray thee, thou art my sister, that it may be well with me for thy sake." So really, you see, what Abraham proposed came to pass. He said that what they ought to do was that it might be well for him as a result of her, verse 13, and that's exactly what happened, verse 16. It was well for him because of her. But you see, this was the reasoning of the flesh, really, wasn't it? Sin deceives and we justify our actions. You see what verse 16 says? It says that Abraham received all these wonderful blessings. It says that he had sheep and oxen and he asses and men servants and maid servants and she asses and camels, and they came piling into his house until he had flocks and herds all around the house where he lived in Egypt. The blessings. But you see, they weren't blessings from God, were they? They were blessings from Pharaoh, says verse 16. Because verse 16 says, he entreated Abram well for her sake. They didn't come from God. They were the blessings of the flesh. And how they must have stung Abraham to the quick. Because as all these animals and all these servants came pouring into his house, he knew, brothers and sisters, that these were the price of his wife. He'd sold her for these animals. How do you think he felt about that? Success in the flesh through compromise in the spirit. Proverbs 15, verse 16, a notable proverb in terms of the lesson, I think, of this verse. Proverbs 15 and verse 16 says, "And oh, how Abram's heart would have ached for this. Was the one time when Abraham would have been absolutely distressed to receive an increase to his flocks and herds." And Proverbs 15 and verse 16 says, "Better is little with the fear of Yahweh than great treasure and trouble therewith." And boy, was this man in trouble right now. He was in grave trouble. And he just wished that he didn't have the treasure that had now been heaped upon him in this verse. In fact, if you come back to Genesis, it's interesting actually, because you see what verse 16 says. It says that he had sheep and oxen and he asses. And you see, what appeared to be a blessing in the end, you see, turned out to be a curse, because in chapter 13 and verse 5, when he comes back up out of the land, we read that Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents, and the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so they could not dwell together, and there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle. And what happened was, the very blessings of cattle and herds and flocks that he received in Egypt later became the cause of friction that led to separation between him and Lot. And they ended up as a curse in his household, not a blessing at all. Actually, Rodham says in verse 16, he entreated Abram well for her sake, and then Rodham says, so that he came to have sheep and oxen. So that he came to have. Now, you see, when you think about that, I think what we're being told, you see, in the 16th verse is that this was probably the process of time. They didn't all arrive on the day after. It was a process of time. There were gifts, and then more gifts, and then further gifts from Pharaoh. Which means, of course, that therefore Sarah must have been in Pharaoh's household, not just for a day, not just for 2 days, but perhaps for a week, another week, a month. We don't know how long. Probably some considerable period of time. Now imagine how Abraham felt as all these presents arrived, and imagine how his wife felt, absolutely cut off from her husband in the royal harem of Pharaoh, not knowing what would befall her, and time passing away. Well, look what did happen, verse 17. And this is interesting. You see, you've got to read the Bible carefully, don't you? It says, and Yahweh plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. But you see the word plague here, it's the word used of leprosy in the law. Now we're not told what the affliction was, but I believe that whatever it was a physical affliction that stopped any relationship between Pharaoh and Sarah. That in some way, God physically afflicted the household of Egypt, including the Pharaoh, so that he could not enter into relations with Sarah. In other words, God moved to protect that woman. And you know why he did it? He certainly didn't do it because of Abraham, did he? He certainly didn't do what he did because of Abraham. I believe that God acted because of the faithfulness of Sarah. Now you see, read verse 17 again carefully. Don't you think it says that? And Yahweh plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. You see, I think God intervened not only to safeguard the promise, but in response to Sarah's faith. It certainly wasn't done for Abraham. It was because she was faithful. And it wasn't just because she was faithful, brothers and sisters. She was something else. She was submissive. Now, come and have a look at the 1st of Peter chapter 3 for a moment, because I believe that the 1st of Peter 3 is actually modelled upon this particular incident in the life of this faithful couple. In the 1st of Peter chapter 3, and reading from the very first verse, let's just capture the spirit of what the apostle says about the principle of submission in the life of a wife. He says this, 1 Peter 3 verse 1, likewise, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they may also without the word be won by the conversation of the wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear. Actually, I've got it on an overhead here, so I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll go through it here. And what I'm going to do is actually show a parallel. We're going to take on the one side, you see, the thoughts of the 1st of Peter 3. And then on the other side, we're going to show how that we believe that the comments of the apostle are drawn not just from the life of Abraham and Sarah, but I believe from the very episode of Genesis chapter 12. Now, you see the first thing that Peter says. He says that if any husbands, understood, obey not the word. And you see, what had happened on this occasion was that Sarah was led by her husband into Egypt. It was the husband that was making the mistake, wasn't it? You see, when Peter says, if any husband obeys not the word, I don't just think that relates to a husband out of the truth. I think it relates to a husband in the truth as well, who's not, in fact, complying with spiritual principles. And this was Abraham on this occasion. He's not obeying the word of God. He leads his wife into a difficult situation. And then you see what it says. It says that if any man obey not the word, verse 1 of 1 Peter 3, they also may without, and you'll notice what I've said on the overhead here, without a word, and that's how it should be translated, be won by the way of life of their wives. The word conversation, of course, here really means way of life. It's not speech, it's deeds. So what this is saying is that a woman can win her husband without speaking a word. And she can win her husband by what she does, not what she says. Now, you know, it's interesting that when you come to the record, of course, of Genesis chapter 12, you know, in that whole story, Sarah never speaks. Did you notice that? Without a word, she won her husband. Now, Peter goes on to say, episode, not Abraham. Abraham's the one making the mistake. Sarah's the one who shows a wonderful spirit of courage and of faith and of submission. Whose adorning, says Peter in verse 3, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair and a wearing of gold and of putting on of apparel. I think from whence we can deduce that whatever Sarah's fairness was like, that her fairness was not based on fashion. There was something more than that, you see, that made Sarah attractive. There was something about her whole personality, her whole deportment, the deportment of a spiritual woman. Isn't there a proverb that says that favour is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth Yahweh, she shall be praised? I think that was Sarah, you see. No, says the apostle, let it be, verse 4, let it be the hidden man of the heart. And you see, I think that's what Sarah did in this episode. You see, what she did is she secretly kept Abraham in her heart. And by the way, that word hidden means exactly that. The word hidden here means concealed or private, and it's generally translated secret. Let it be the secret man of the heart. And what Sarah did was she secretly enshrined her husband in her heart. Why secret? Because she was in another man's household. And while she was in Pharaoh's household, she still called Abram Lord in her heart, even though he had let her down badly. And so Peter says, verse 5, for after this manner in the old time, the holy woman also, who trusted in God, adorned themselves. And you see, I think this is the great lesson, you see, of chapter 12 in Genesis. You see, what was Sarah to do in this episode? What could Sarah do? Her husband watched her walk away. She went in the company of the princes into the house of Pharaoh. What could Sarah do but one thing? She said, in effect, she said, there's nothing I can do but put my trust in Yahweh. I've got to hand this matter over to the Father. I can't do anything but trust him. And see, I think that's exactly what she did do, you see. She committed the matter absolutely to God on this occasion. And she submitted to Abraham's request in the matter of calling herself his sister. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, says the record, calling him Lord. And you see, I think that's what happened, is that her obedience on this occasion to her husband was truly from the heart. And then you notice that Peter says this, verse 6 of Peter, he says, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well and are not afraid with any amazement. And so, you see, I think what Peter is saying is that Sarah showed faith in this particular episode at a time of great terror and alarm. Now, if you want to be like Sarah, says Peter, then you ought to show the same spirit. And she showed a spirit of submission to her husband at an extreme moment in their life. Now you see,
I think part of the problem here is that we live in an age, you see, where both women's liberation and other developments in the culture, particularly of the Western world, have changed the view of people on this, haven't they? And
somehow submission is not seen now as such an important thing in marriage, but from the divine perspective it always has been, and I think still is. It's the great principle as far as the woman is concerned, is learning the spirit of submission. You see, it's in all these major passages, isn't it, in the New Testament, that deal with husband-wife relationships. Ephesians chapter 5, the 1st of Peter chapter 3, Colossians chapter 3, Titus chapter 2. The principle of submission is over and over again referred to. Now you see, we ought not to think as a result of this that Sarah was a meek woman, or that Abraham was a domineering husband. Submission doesn't mean that a woman doesn't have her own thoughts and her own heart on the matter. You see, Sarah was a strong-minded woman. She was passionate about her principles. She felt strongly about things. In fact, later on in the record, we're going to find that she spoke very strongly to Abraham on at least, well, several occasions. You see, learning submission doesn't mean that a wife never talks. Learning submission doesn't mean that a wife never communicates her feelings with her husband. What it does mean, though, is that when the principles have all been discussed and the communication has all ended, that Sarah deferred to her husband, as wives should to theirs. How far do you think the principle of submission extends? And you see, I think the answer is it extends as far as a godly woman will extend it. But people say, oh well, that's all very well, but you haven't met my husband. And you see, you've got sisters that say, well, I'm quite prepared to submit to my wife, to my husband rather, as long as I see my husband behaving himself and living a spiritual life and living up to being the head of the house. But I don't see why I should submit to him when he's not playing his part properly. But isn't the very thing that Peter says? Peter says, not that you ought to submit when a husband's behaving himself, but he says, if any man obey not the word, learn submission. It's easy for a wife to submit to her husband when he's displaying marvellous spiritual characteristics as the head of the house. The really tough one is to submit to him when he's not. And isn't that exactly what Sarah experiences in Genesis chapter 12? Her husband was the one in the wrong. Her husband was the one not displaying faith. Her husband was the one who was spiritually weak, and she still submitted to him. Do you know what the apostle says? Wives, be in subjection to your husbands in everything, says the apostle in Ephesians chapter 5. This is a hard one, isn't it? I think this is the hardest thing for a woman to learn. So how did Sarah do it? How really did Sarah do it? Let's come back to Genesis chapter 12. How did she do it? Well, I think what she did is exactly what Peter said, by the way, is he said, let it be the hidden man of the heart. Now, you see, we know that when Peter refers to the hidden man of the heart, who does he really mean? Who's the hidden man of the heart, really? And the answer is Christ, isn't it? Isn't he the hidden man of the heart? But you see, in a marriage relationship, the husband is Christ. He represents Christ. And the wife ought to look up to him as Christ. Even when he's not manifesting the Spirit of Christ, she ought to try and look up to him as Christ. And so she enshrines Christ in her heart. And that helps her to submit to her husband. So you see, I guess the lesson of the story is, it's not the woman on the outside that counts. It's the man on the inside that counts. That's the really important thing, isn't it? It's whether the husband or Christ or both have been truly enshrined in the wife's heart. You know, it's interesting, you know, that Peter says that a woman can win her husband in these circumstances without a word. And we come back to Genesis 12 and we never hear a peep out of Sarah. You know, one of the worst things, brothers and sisters, one of the worst things that a wife can do in a situation like this when a man's made a bad mistake is to tell him. You know, when it's all over, she says, well, look, you might have known this, and away she goes. Whew. And the husband knows he's wrong. But the more she says, the more he digs in his toes, and the more she says, and in the end he says, well, look, I know I'm wrong, but too bad. And he behaves unreasonably, doesn't he? You know, I think one of the lessons of this story out of Sarah on this occasion in Genesis chapter 12 is that, you see, she practiced the spirit of Peter. She was silent. There's no word of rebuke from Sarah after the incident is over. And you see, I think this, and it's a lesson for all women to learn in the interest of good and happy married life, is this. Believe it, that a woman's silence in the face of a husband's failure is a far, far more eloquent rebuke than any words she might say. Any husband who's got an ounce of goodness in him, when he knows that he's at fault and he's hurt his wife and she does not respond in kind, he'll learn out of that. You don't need to say anything, wives. He'll learn. And the very fact that you don't say anything will sting him far more than if you did. Better to shut the doors of your mouth. As Sarah did, we believe, on this occasion. You see, by the way, I think one of the reasons why she did this was that they'd agreed to it. We're told, by the way, later on in chapter 20, that they'd agreed. Before they came, they'd agreed that she would say she was his sister. And therefore, Sarah acquiesced in that matter, even though she knew Abraham was wrong, because she'd agreed on that matter with him, and she stood by that agreement. She enshrined her husband in her heart, and in silence she placed the matter before Almighty God, and God wonderfully, wonderfully intervened in this story. And verse 18 goes on to say, it says, Pharaoh called Abram and said, and now look what he says, what is this that thou hast done? Why didst thou not tell me, verse 19, why saidest thou, and you get this barrage of questions now, indignant questions, as a Gentile monarch justly rebukes the man of God. And Pharaoh basically hauls Abraham over the coals, doesn't he? And rightly so. Why did you do this, says Pharaoh? What have you done? Why didn't you tell me? And you see, Abram had made a bad mistake. He'd misjudged Pharaoh, hadn't he? Pharaoh was a far more righteous man than you might have thought. Verse 19 says, and you see how close this crisis came. Oh, you see how desperately close it came. Verse 19, why saidest thou, she is my sister, so I might have taken her to me to wife? But that's not what Rotherham says. Rotherham says, so I was about to take her to wife. So Abraham is not rebuked only for his deception, but because that deception had almost led to further sin. Pharaoh, a man ignorant of the truth, was still a man with sufficient integrity to repudiate an adulterous union with another man's wife. And he said, I want no part of it. But his intention was genuine. He says, I was just about to marry her. Now you see how desperately close the matter of this promised seed came if God hadn't intervened because of a righteous woman. You see, the tragedy was that even though God intervened, and even though in that sense the situation was restored, these words came to be true. You don't need to turn them up, but you might like to take a note of them in the 2nd of Samuel 12 and verse 14. And in fact, they're the words recorded after David's great compromise. And these are the words, howbeit, by this deed, thou hast given great occasion to the enemies of Yahweh to blaspheme. And that was the real shame, wasn't it? The truth had been brought into disrepute by Abraham on this occasion. God had intervened and the situation had been remarkably saved. But the truth itself had been brought into disrepute. And so Pharaoh says at the end of the verse, he says, verse 19, "Now therefore," and in the Hebrew, by the way, the words are very abrupt, "behold, take, go." And he doesn't allow any further debate, any further discussion. And Abraham is taught a great lesson. You know the lesson he was taught, I believe, in this chapter? Isn't that the lesson? Or at least one of them? Learning the principle of honesty in life. And not only honesty in life, but you'll notice that these passages, the 1 Thessalonians 4 verse 12, "walk honestly to them that are without." Romans 12 verse 7, "recompense to no man evil for evil, provide things honest in the sight of all men." 1 Timothy 2 verses 1 and 2, "let prayers be made for all men, for kings and all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty," says the record. And finally, in the 1 Peter chapter 2 verses 9 to 12, "as strangers and pilgrims," says the apostle, "abstain from fleshly lusts, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles." Honest among the Gentiles. That's where Abram had gone wrong. And he learnt a valuable lesson from a Gentile monarch on this occasion, who justly rebukes him for a lesson that he ought to learn. You see what verse 20 says of Genesis? It says, "And Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, and his wife, and all that he had." And somehow, you see, in the reading of that verse, what we're given really is the absolute reversal of the terms of verse 15, really, aren't we? You see what happens here. You see, in verse 15, it says that the princes commended her to Pharaoh, and she was taken in. And now in verse 20, we read that Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and he was sent away. And all things turned full circle. You see, God's reversed the whole unfortunate cycle of error that Abraham has got himself into here. And he's sent away out of the land of Egypt. You see what verse 20 says? "Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away, and his wife, and all that he had." And by the way, that phrase, "all that he had," you know that, what that would include? Not just the sheep, not just the oxen, but the men servants and the maid servants and the members of his household, who all left Egypt in disgrace as a result of the failure of their master to be honest in the sight of the Gentiles. That wasn't a good day for Abram, was it? But a wonderful demonstration of the spirit of true submission by his wife. You know, brothers and sisters, it would be fair to say in this particular context that Sarah's submission saved their family in this day. Sarah's submission saved the family. And a divine intervention was wrought because of the goodness of that woman. And then chapter 13 verse 1 says, "And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the south." And so, just you see, as the record had spoken about going down into Egypt, now he comes back up. And how thankful he was. He came back up out of Egypt. It was a spiritual ascent. You know that Abraham never, ever left the land of Israel again. Well, that was one good thing, wasn't it? One excursion into Egypt was enough for him. He never ever left the land again after this. And what does it say? Verse 1. Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife. Well, here's his wife again. Now, let's just count up the number of times that she's mentioned as his wife in this story. Verse 11 of chapter 12, his wife. Verse 12, so that's 2, his wife. Verse 17, Abram's wife. Verse 18, thy wife. Verse 19, thy wife. So that's 5. Verse 20, his wife. So that's 6. Chapter 13, verse 1, his wife. So that's 7. 7 times she is described as his wife in this particular story. Now, what seven's the number of, don't you? Seven's the number of covenant, isn't it? She was the wife of his covenant. Now, does that remind you of a Bible passage anywhere? The wife of his covenant. Malachi chapter 2. Come and have a look at Malachi chapter 2 just for a moment. Malachi 2, verse 14. Yet ye say, wherefore? Because Yahweh hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant, says Malachi. And you see, that was Sarah's position. She was the wife of his covenant. They'd made marriage vows together, had Abram and Sarah. And yet on this occasion it says that God was a witness between Abraham and his wife. And the way in which God was a witness between the two is that he'd intervened to save the wife because of the faithlessness of the husband. And verse 15 of Malachi goes on to say, and did not God make one, yet had he the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one? Now, by the way, what Malachi means when he says that is, in effect, what he says is, did not he make one wife for one man, and yet had he the residue of the Spirit? In other words, God had enough Spirit to make 10 wives for one man if he'd wanted to, but he never did he? God, with all the Spirit at his power, at his fingertips, only made one man and one wife. Why, says Malachi, verse 15, that he might seek a godly seed out of that relationship. And that was the very thing that Abraham didn't understand at this stage. He truly didn't understand that his wife was involved in the bearing of this godly seed, and he'd brought them both into great danger as a result of this episode. And verse 15 goes on to say, therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. You see the word treacherously there? It means to act deceitfully so as to be unfaithful. Now you see, Abraham hadn't been unfaithful to his wife in terms of taking another woman, but he had been unfaithful to his wife in exposing her to the attentions of another man through his own lack of headship on this occasion. And therefore, when Genesis chapter 13 and verse 1 says he came up out of the land of Egypt, he and his wife, the fact is, brothers and sisters, he was lucky to have her. He was blessed to still have her in view of his absolute failure as a husband to look after his wife, to shelter his wife, to guide his wife. And so it is a subdued and chastened man, we believe, who sets his face now again towards the land of promise. But verse 3 says of Genesis chapter 13, he went on his journeys from the south even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai, unto the place. Now you see, when you read verses 3 and 4, do you notice that you've got a sense of you see, Rotherham says he went by his removals. Literally in the Hebrew it means he went by his stations. The Vulgate says he went back by the same route he had gone. You see the phrase, he went on his journeys, in verse 3, you notice how similar that is to chapter 12 verse 9. Abraham journeyed, going on still toward the south. Now he's coming up from the south, and what he's doing is he's retracing his steps, you see. And so you see, all the language of verses 3 and 4 is the language of a man trying to undo his mistake. You see the words? So, from, to, unto, where he had been, between, unto, where he was at the first. There, says verse 4. Now, where was there? And the answer is Bethel, verse 3. Back, 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 back he goes to the house of God. Back to where he had been, verse 4, at the very first. Back to the beginning, back to where it all started. Every phrase, you see, in these verses is eloquent of Abraham's fresh start in life. He'd made a bad mistake, but one of the wonderful things about Abraham, brothers and sisters, is he tries to recover himself. And he retraces his way all the way back to where he ought to have been from the very beginning. And verse 4 says at the end of the verse, and there Abram called on the name of Yahweh. You know, Proverbs 24 and verse 16 says, a righteous man falleth down seven times and riseth up again. And that was the spirit of this man. The greatness of Abram's faith, you see, is that he fell down badly here, but he tries to get up again. He tries to get up again. That's what we've got to do in our marriages. Of course we're going to fall down. But we're going to get back up again. We've got to retrace our steps back to where it's right. And so the end of this whole episode is, at the end of verse 4, and there Abram called on the name of Yahweh. Oh, what a prayer that would have been, brothers and sisters. Can you imagine what that prayer would have been about? Open confession of failure. Thankful acceptance of divine providence. Deep resolution to begin again with God's help. And when the prayers, brothers and sisters, were all over, would there not also be a moment in the quietness of the tent to seek reconciliation with his wife and to plead her forgiveness also? This was a chastening moment, wasn't it? For Abraham. You see, they weren't immune from failure, were they? But the record shows the greatness of their life lay in the fact that they tried to learn from their mistakes, to try to learn the lessons of their life. And what were the lessons? Well, here are the lessons, you see, of this episode. Life in the truth involves trial, but the solution never lies in turning to the world. In fact, it's very difficult to assess a problem when already entangled in it. Involvement with the world inevitably diminishes spiritual perception and leads to sin. And sin, well, sin deceives and multiplies in its effects. Abraham's faith could not yet conquer fear. But Sarah's submission saved their whole household from disaster. Certainly, the truth is brought into disrepute where honesty is lacking. But faith, in the end, brothers and sisters, will help us to rise up from failure and begin life anew, as we should, in facing the problems of our own life. And it all began when a man went south because of famine, who trusted not in God's gracious provisions. The eyes of all things, Lord, attend, and on thee wait, but here do live. And thou in season due, dost send sufficient food them to relieve.